Good afternoon and welcome again to Revegetation and Restoration of an Oil Contaminated Wetland in Northern New Jersey, which is today's internet webcast. It's sponsored by the EPA's Office of Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. My name is Ellen and I'm with EPA and I will be moderating today's session. While we wait for a couple more people to log in, we'll cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the URL. That is the front page of today's seminar, and you should, there's a short abstract there, abstract of today's session there. We also have included bio sketches of the presenters, which I encourage you to read, along with pictures. The presenters' email address are also hot linked on this page, so this is good to note. So if you have any questions for one of them after today's presentation, feel free to send them an email. Key things here, if you're joining us via the phone lines, please put your phone on mute. If you do not have a mute button, you can push *6. Also, please do not put us on hold. Lots of times there's music and advertisements, which will obviously disrupt the internet training. Okay, so hopefully by now you've clicked on the agenda for today. Go to session icon. And you should be on slide number 1 of the presentation. You'll see the introductory slide. If you look above that slide, you can see the icons that can push you forward or backward. While the speaker presents, he'll tell you what slide we're on, so you can use those icons to advance, or you can hit the slide number on the left side. Please note the question mark icon. That's where you could submit your questions. And I encourage you to submit your questions while you think of them and not wait for a question-answer period. We'll have two question-answer periods, one in the middle and then one towards the end. So please submit your questions when you think of them. Also, if you experience any technical difficulties, hit that question mark icon, tell us what your problem is, and please include a phone number so we can contact you. At the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through our links page. We have a series of documents and databases, other information. Also, this webcast will be archived, so you can listen to it at another time or refer to another employee. So I think we're ready to kick off the session. We have two speakers today. We're very lucky to have them. Our first speaker is Mike Zalecki. He has been with EPA for the last 13 years in a Region 2 office. Prior to joining EPA, he had a distinguished response career, beginning as a firefighter. He developed a new curriculum research program for fire protection and prevention sciences at the University of Tennessee and became a full-time instructor. He entered the Naval Service in 1981, and in 1987, he assigned as a liaison of EPA's environmental response team, and then joined the EPA in 1993. Our second speaker is Dr. Royal Nadeau. Royal, Mike, is it all staticky on your end?
What's that, Ellen?
Is it staticky on your end?
No.
Okay. If anybody's having any static problems, please put in there's a little static. Please submit to the question mark icon and we can clear that up. Dr. Nadeau was with EPA for 31 years. He was a charter member of the U.S. EPA's Environmental Response Team and serves as a Deputy Center Director of the ERT. He has his B.S. in Science, his M.S. in Zoology, and his Ph.D. in Ecology. Currently, Royal serves as President and Certified Senior Ecologist with the Eco Strategies Group, an ecological consulting firm that specializes in ecological restoration, invasive species management, and land evaluations in the Northeast. So before I turn it over to Mike, can I please remind the participants to put your phone on mute? If you don't have a mute button, please hit *6, and please do not put us on hold. So thank you, and welcome, Mike and Royal.
Okay. All right. Well, as we all know, removing oil is not exactly the easiest thing in the world. Very time-consuming, expensive, especially when you're dealing with critical habitats and ecologically sensitive areas. In the past, the removals have had very deleterious effects in that the restoration wasn't exactly restoration. They would use seeding, hydro seeding, and just basically put down grasses or build a park or something like that. But in this particular project, we decided to go a little bit farther and replace all of the plants, flowers, and things according to the way they are naturally, as opposed to building a park or an arboretum or something like that. But the first thing we had to deal with, which is what I want to talk about, is the removal of the oil and give you a little history of the background of the site. And then Royal will come in later and talk to you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees. Okay, your second slide, we're on slide two now. Basically a sketch of the oil pipeline that used to run across the southern tier of New York from DeBayo, New Jersey, from Olean, New York. And it was a 315-mile construction, started in 1881. They put in the fourth line about 3 years later and put out about 50,000 barrels a day. Used to flow through the pipeline. They used to lose a lot as well because the pipeline was made of wood with no lining. And eventually they did put in 1909, I believe it was, they put in the steel pipe. In 1916, at our particular site, they had to, because it was leaked, the pipeline and the pumping station was leaking into the river, the Pequannock River, they decided to bypass that section of the pipeline and go around Barefoot Mountain. And then continue it on down into Bayonne, keeping it away from the water supply. About that time, the city of Newark decided that they needed more water, so they decided to also draw out of the Pequannock River directly, as opposed to coming out of the Passaic and the Hackensack the way they were coming at that present time. And that was about 1920 that happened. There is still a relic pumping station around. That is in Unionville, New York, which is... There's three?
No,
slide three. I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you what slide. Slide three. Sorry. There's a picture of the pumping station. It's in this particular one is in Unionville, New York. It's almost exact replica of the one that was in Newfoundland, which was, like I said, removed in 1920. There's 11 stations, 28 miles apart over the 315-mile distance. There are 6-inch diameter pipes, which I had mentioned, all made of wood. The maximum capacity was 50,000 barrels a day, and it operated from 1881 to 1920. Slide 4. On August 10, 2004, the Highlands Water Protection and Planning Act went into effect. This particular law will protect drinking water for over 5.4 million people, preserve open space, and provide effective regional planning for the Highlands region of New Jersey. In addition to the water resources, the Highlands region contains exceptional natural resources such as contiguous forest lands, wetlands, pristine watersheds, plant, wildlife, species, habitats, and the region contains many sites of historic significance as well, which provides tons of recreational opportunities. Number 5, this is an aerial view of the city of Newark's watershed itself. You can see how many lakes are all involved in its watershed system. This particular area is 35 miles northwest of the city of Newark, in portions of Morris, Passaic, and Sussex counties. The area consists of about 35,000 square acres that contain 5 major reservoirs. They're all in the Pequannock River system. Regarded by the heart of the highlands, as the heart of the highlands, the Pequannock watershed provides critical water supplies for more than 500,000 people in New Jersey and Newark and other New Jersey citizens along the route. And it's very sensitive wildlife from otters to eagles, bears, and bobcats. The aerial view that you see in slide number 6 is the actual site itself. You can see the red dots outline the site. It's about 1.3 acres, or about a half a hectare, in size. The borders are the Pequannock River itself, which serves as the connecting stream between the two reservoirs of the Oak Ridge and the Charlottesburg reservoirs. It's all part of the Newark supply, like I had mentioned before. The stream volume and current is regulated by the City of Newark Water Management Authority. Slide number 7. To give you an idea of the background of the site itself, in February 1996, the water table was exceptionally high that year because of rain events and melting snow all happened to hit at one time. The water table and oil surface on the adjacent wetland located between the pump, what used to be the pumping station site and the Pequannock River itself, and ultimately discharged into the river. We're not sure actually how often this phenomenon had occurred prior to this event that was actually found, but apparently it happened several times over the years, but nobody actually reported it to anybody. He said, "Oh yeah, it smells like oil here all the time," and then finally somebody reported it to the National Response Center, which had the state of New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection and the U.S. EPA to respond. In the winter of 1996, the water table being, like I said, being exceptionally high, leaked out through the ground. Basically, we kind of laughed about it and called it to pull the Jed Clampett, because everywhere you stepped, your footprint would fill up with oil. And at that point, we decided something was definitely wrong, so we boomed off the area to protect any type of adsorbent boom and the containment boom, to prevent any more from going out into the river itself, and then we tried to find the source. At that time, we didn't even know there was a pumping station at the at that particular site, so we did a historical track down of the properties and all of that to find out that, yeah, it used to be part of the Olean Bayonne pipeline, which basically everybody forgot about, because by the time of the spill, most of the people who even knew it existed had already passed on. So what we ended up doing was, through the state and through EPA, we got funded through the OPA, Oil Pollution Act, and funded the program and decided to figure out a way to clean it up. Well, it being a groundwater problem, because the oil is actually setting stratified in the ground, in the soil above the groundwater, and the rising groundwater is what pushed it up out of the soil. If you go to the next slide. My slide didn't change. There we go.
Hey, Mike.
I got it.
Mike, this is on. Some people are having a hard time hearing you guys. Can you speak up, or do you have a headset?
Yeah, I'll just get closer to the speakerphone.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Sorry about that. There went the speakerphone. Technical difficulties. Never fails, does it? I'll hold it. All right, here we go. All right, I hope that's better. I'll also raise my voice some, what's left of it. Okay, so anyway, because of it being frozen over, as you saw in the previous picture, we had a hard time being able to cut through the soil to find out what exactly is going on, so we basically isolated it at that time and decided that in the spring, as soon as we had the melt, we had a 52-inch frost line at that particular site, so we had to wait quite a while. So in the late spring, we went and sunk piezometers, which are basically small monitoring wells, and sampled to find out that we had a lot of oil under the ground. We estimated somewhere between 150 and 200,000 gallons of crude oil, which I should have mentioned that the oil itself is New York crude, or is Pennsylvania grade crude from New York, and it's a fairly viscous oil, and but it's missing most of its top end because it was weathered over the last 100 years or so. So we went ahead, and by that time, of course, if you look at the next slide, in June of 1998, which is later on, this gives you an idea of what it looked like right that next year in the summer in the wetland. But all of that was still as you walk through that particular section of the wetland, the oil was bubbling up into your feet, so it was still a lot of oil. What we decided to do was sink wells at different depths, of course, and recover the oil. We set up a system where we were able to pump the water back upstream of groundwater and we were able to recycle the groundwater as opposed to bringing in fresh water from the river or anything. So we did the least amount of effect on the river that we could possibly do. And what we were able to do is we were able to separate in the wells themselves. That we had special pumps designed where we actually separated the oil from the water and pumped the oil out, and the water we recycled back. So we weren't really we were causing our own gradient, basically. So about 2 years later, we had already removed close to 40,000 gallons of oil, and then we decided it's time to restore the wetland to its natural state. So if you go to slide 10, okay, we decided to go ahead and strip down all of the overgrowth that was there that you saw in the previous picture. We went down to bare dirt and decided that if we're going to restore it the way it was as opposed to with any invasives or anything like that. And just basically let it go by itself, which is what you saw in the previous picture. So we went ahead and we got a lot of, which I'll get into a little later, different organizations together to decide what plants we're going to put in. But to, just to show you what we've done on the from the ground portion of it, if you look at this slide, in the upper left-hand corner slide, you'll see that there's a matting along the river, or along the riverbank. And that's it's a coconut type of matting, and it's used to reinforce the bank so that it cuts down on the erosion, since there's not going to be any plants there for a little while. And then to the right there, you see we scraped all the oiled soil out and removed it and had it, you know, disposed of properly through incineration. And then we set up a silt fence system, and we went ahead and graded the actual plot of land as loosely as we can. We allowed the dips. We didn't make it perfectly flat like a tabletop. We sloped it. We left dips in it, in ditches. In other words, we didn't refine it to plant grass. We just left it pretty rough. If you go to the next slide, it's a picture from across the river at the site just before we were getting ready to begin planting. All right. What we also did was we used coir logs. I don't know if you know what they are, but they're basic. They look like a telephone pole, but they're made out of coconut, shredded coconut. And that we also use that to help reinforce the bank and actually make a solid bank. And the good thing about this stuff is if you ever get a chance to use it, it will actually act as soil and you can actually grow plants through it. We had actually planted plants within that coir log and they're still there. They survived very well. If you go to the next slide, okay, we got everybody together, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Resource Conservation Service, the Morris County Soil Conservation Service, of course EPA, NJDEP, and several other organizations to try and come up with a scheme to put this all together. We signed interagency agreements with all these groups to allow them to have funding. Which you always have to do with the government. They have to get funded from somewhere. And we got them together, and the National Resource Conservation Service came in and did a study of the land. And if you go to the next slide, you can see it was a palustrine, scrub, shrub, broadleaf, deciduous swamp. Okay, so this is a mouthful for me because I'm a dirt guy. So they selected the plants for us. And we came up with a planting scheme. If you go to the next slide, it'll give you a sketch map. And this is basic contour map, and it shows where we had our little dips and where we were able to contour the ground so that we can make it more natural so that we have upper areas and lower areas within the whole wetland itself. We tried to take it as much from the original as we possibly could. Even though we had to go in and tear everything out, we still tried to restore the ground surface and the topography exactly the way it was before. And that's not an easy task, especially when you got a bulldozer driver who really likes to drive his bulldozer. So you have to really watch these guys when you get them out there. They're very good, but you really need to tell them what to do. Don't just say, go flatten that out, because that's exactly what you'll get. Next slide. This is a picture of the plant itself where we decided We're going to plant the specific plants. Royal will get into it in a little bit on the color, on what we put where and how they grouped everything. And I believe that should be. Oh no, this here is part of the plant. This is a list of the plants that we selected and how many units of each. And the next slide, what we did was to install all these things. We had an Earth Day thing. We put it together and opened it up to the community, and volunteers came in and actually gave us free labor to plant all the plants, which was pretty cool. There were a lot of people that, you know, that showed up. We had, you know, little refreshments for them and everything. It was a pretty cool little day, and it worked out real well. And it gave the community a chance to come in and see that EPA is actually doing something for them and for their area. And it got us a lot of points, which we always need. And this will give you an idea of what we had to do here. These are the plants placed. What we are having is, since we are so late in the season itself, in the growing season, we had to go to potted plants. We originally were going to use live stem, but we were too late in the year. Evidently, all that has to start in March. Well, unfortunately, that particular year in March, the ground was still frozen, and we had to go to potted plants instead of the live shrub. You can see in the picture on the right, the gentleman there is slam barring into the coir log. You're actually going to plant plants right into the coir log. We did a few extra plants in the shrubs to see if they would actually hold up. And they actually did, and they're still alive today because we kept track of them. And it worked out real well. Yeah. Okay, just for a little reference, we're on slide 20, one of the slides, slide 19 right now. And this is Royal's going to take over now because he's the guy who kept track of all the plants and the flowers and everything else that we had going on there. But thank you. We have to make a microphone adjustment. Okay. We should be on slide 19, in which case you can see that we have the species of shrubs that we decided that we would use there. And these are all native to the northeast and to this particular area of New Jersey. And you can see that we had the shrub species, and then in the coir logs we planted the cardinal flower, which is lobelia, and then some rushes and some other herbaceous plants as well. Now, after the first growing season, you can get an idea of our survivability there, or at the end of that particular season. You can see that we didn't do too well with our herbaceous plants, and that was on account of the fact that we had a very, very dry summer, and you must remember that the stream at this point is highly regulated, and so the City of Newark's Water Management Department had lowered the stream considerably, which meant that our wetland plants were high and dry during the greater part of the summer. So our survivability suffered in this particular case. However, the next year, or I should say the following year, we did take some measurements as to not only how well the plants were doing, but also how they were growing. And these measurements were made by measuring the height. And you can see, this is on slide 20. And I might add that when you embark on a revegetation project like this, it's very important to keep track of how well your plant materials are doing in order to make a determination as to, number one, if you're doing if they are surviving, and then at number two, if they are growing. And the idea that if some of them are having a problem, you may decide to replace those particular species with another one, another wetland species that is doing better on your particular site. So that's a judgment call, and you don't have to make that right off in the start. You can wait a year or two. Now, one of the things I should point out that this particular site is that each spring at a high water event, we would end up with having some oil that would still be coming out of the soils. And so there was a question of whether or not this oil, this periodic oiling, would be affecting the planted material. That this is slide 21. So as you can see, this you can see the oil actually there floating on the water. Now, during the winter time, the recovery system is usually not operating. So this would be this oil would come to the surface largely because we were not able to keep the recovery system going during the winter months. Now, on slide 22, you can see what there were certain particular areas in the marsh that we seem to have these little oil springs, which Mike turned them, come up with a new term called a spooge, which has now become a standard vernacular vocabulary within the oil still community. So next time you hear the term spooge, you can credit it to Mike Selecki. Now what Mike first did was then when we identified these particular areas where the oil seemed to be popping up on a more regular basis, he would then plaster that area with absorbent pads and the absorbent boom that you see there. And that would do a good job with holding the oil and then not allowing it to go any further out and reaching the river itself. Now the next slide, 23.
This is Ellen. Can you move the speaker closer to you?
Sure.
Okay. People are having some difficulty hearing.
I'm going to turn it around. Try that.
Sorry for the technical difficulties. It'll just be a minute. This way everyone will be able to hear better. Well, this is a good time to encourage questions. We'll probably be taking a break in another handful of slides. And also to let you know that at the end of the seminar, there's a survey for your comments, and we really do look at them, so please write in any comments when we're done with the seminar.
Thank you.
Where are you all set? Hello? Mike? Anyone?
Your audience is still here.
That's good to know. I've never had this happen before.
I'm back with you.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Okay, we'll try to work this a little better so I don't end up, pressing the wrong button, hanging up on you. All right. Maybe how about if I just hold it up like this? I basically have the microphone right next to my mouth. How's that?
It sounds better to me. I'll see what people say.
Okay. Well, that's the way we'll do it. We'll keep it going. Okay. When I left you, I was on slide 23. And because of the fact that we were seeing these spooges that were releasing oil, at least in the early years, on a periodic basis, there was a concern that what impact these oiling might have on our fresh
our fresh shrubs that we had installed. So we embarked on a monitoring program that actually entailed taking oil samples at different places in the wetland and then having these analyzed to determine what levels there were of the total petroleum hydrocarbons, because it was a fairly well-established scientific fact in the literature that if levels were, say, at percent levels, like 2 to 3%, that would definitely be toxic to your plant materials. So here's, let's go to slide 24. And this gives you, I know it's a very busy slide, and I apologize for that, but you can see that in April of 99, which is the third column from the left, it gives you some idea of what the levels were. These levels were expressed in ppm. So we were definitely not in the area that, as far as concentration, that we felt were going to present a problem regarding the survive, in terms of the shrubbery. And as time went along, as you can see, if you move over to the right, the concentrations actually diminished at most places, except in the areas that were immediately adjacent to the sludge. I might add, and I'll probably be able to show you a picture a little bit later of some of the vegetation that was actually growing in and around near the sludge areas. And surprisingly, that vegetation seemed did as well, if not better, than some of the other plants. It was well established. Keeping in mind that when Mike did the oil removal, he did not take an awful lot of soil, and he certainly didn't take much in terms of the root systems that had been well established there with the, say, the tussock sedges and other wetland plants that had been well established before they still took place, which is very important when it comes to doing a rehabilitation or restoration from an oil spill in a wetland is that you minimize the removal. You only remove as much oily debris as you really have to so that it doesn't serve as a reservoir for oil to get into the river system or into the. So we're now on slide 25. And we were concerned not only with the total petroleum hydrocarbons, which were one of the measurements, but we were also wondering a little bit about the nature of the oil. Mike had mentioned a little bit earlier about how the lighter ends of the oil had weathered off during the course of the 100 years that it had actually sat in the ground. And so we were interested in knowing whether or not because there was the possibility that there was some other sources from around the area. Maybe there was one site that had a gasoline spill and that was not far away. So we were wanting to make certain that the oil that we were dealing with was from the pipeline itself. And so we had a fingerprint analysis performed on the samples that we took there in the marsh. And what came out of that analysis was that we had, even though they were identified as hydrocarbons, and some of which were probably from petroleum, there was presence of hydrocarbons that were from natural sources or unidentified sources. And that's something that one must also remember when you're in the business of taking samples, especially oil samples, in the wild, so to speak, is that you probably, if you especially deal with these very sophisticated analysis using fingerprint analysis, you may wind up with finding hydrocarbons that are not non-petroleum in nature. Now, of course, in that case, then one would have to say, well, those hydrocarbons are not likely to present a problem to you since they are naturally occurring. Now, slide 26. Naturally, we wanted to know how our vegetation was going to be doing in terms of growth. So we established a reference point to perform the photo documentation. This reference point became known as the Photo Rock, and it was a glacier erratic boulder that was located in the northern end of the site, and it provided a great place to climb up on and take these views that you see here expressed in the upper left-hand corner, starting out with the spring of 99 and following right on through to summer of 2003. Now, here we actually took with our monitoring program, we monitored in the springtime and in late fall because of the species, the wetland species, of course. Those of you that are wetland enthusiasts know that you have a different array of species associated with wetlands in the spring and in the late fall. So this is what you see here is sort of like the first year, the first spring following installation. And so we had some interesting species that were came in first, or our early pioneers. The skunk cabbage had been there all along, and because it had a established root system, it popped up very, very noticeably in the spring, along with the jack in the pulpit. Okay, I think, Ellen, I think is this the point at which we decided would be a good time to...
This is a great time. We're going to take a break for questions. I have a bunch of questions that were written into me, which I can read off, and then we'll go back and forth between the phone and the internet questions. So why don't I start it out? We have Jean from Pennsylvania who submitted a question. Says, is it possible to present the cost involved for this effort, and how do they compare to other restoration projects of a similar nature? And they also said it was an excellent presentation.
Now, the cost for the actual plant materials installation, and Mike, check me, you had actually went out with three bids once the restoration team decided the number of plants and the species, and we were fortunate again, there is a native plant supplier in New Jersey that had this stock. But I recollect that it was in the neighborhood of $10,000.
Well, it was 15 total if you count everything. Transportation, installation, about $15,000 for the whole.
Yeah. Were you able to hear that?
Can you repeat that?
It was $15,000 total. That included the labor and getting the plants transported to us and collecting them and everything. That was the total cost for the restoration itself. Was $15,000 for the plant material.
Now, later on, when I finished talking about the monitoring program and what was involved in doing the transects and the species, the plant community differentiation, I can then finish up with talking about what was involved in actually conducting the monitoring program itself. Now, was the question had to do with the cost of the cleanup?
Is it possible to present the cost involved for this effort, and how do they compare to other restoration projects of a similar nature?
The project itself, including the removal of the oil, was about $1.5 million. But the restoration was minimal compared to compared to the cost of the entire project. It was well worth going. In other words, it only cost us maybe $5,000 more to do this than it would have if we had to go in and just hydro seed or something like that. So it's actually it was well worth the effort from an ecological standpoint, in that it was only about $5,000 extra than what it would have cost us if we didn't do the restoration.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. Let's go on to our next question. John from Pennsylvania asks, if you were involved with a project like this today, would you do anything different?
No, I really wouldn't. I would probably just change the ways that we went about it at the very beginning. In that we would monitor a lot sooner, and we would do things a little bit differently as far as, because technology has changed since 1996 as well. So there's a lot of easier ways to spot where the oil actually is laying, and we probably could have removed a lot more oil if we had used a little bit different method. But that method wasn't available to us at that time, so we went with what we had for the 5 years that we ran the project.
Great. Let's ask one more question online, and then we'll open it to the phone lines. William from Pennsylvania asked, in retrospect, do you have any considerations to keep the unwanted visitors out of the revegetated and restored areas?
Like what kind of unwanted visitors? We had deer fence went all the way around and pretty much kept the deer out. The bears tended to get in anyway, and the beavers also got in, as you'll show you a slide later with the herbivory that was going on during one of our seasons. But as far as that goes, this place was secluded enough that nobody really bothered it anyway. And it really helped to have the farmer on the corner sit on his porch with a shotgun often to keep people out anyway, because he doesn't want people on his own property. So we lucked out in that.
Great, thanks. Let's open it up to the phone lines. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute and go ahead. Anyone?
Yeah, this is Charles Brigance. I'm with in Texas, PCEQ. When they were investigating this site, did they also check the river's surface water and sediments to see if they were affected?
Yes, we did. We did sediment samples in the bottom of the river and found nothing. There was some in the bank, and we did have one area downstream. Our groundwater shifted through the year. In the summer, it had a northerly kind of flow, and in the summer, it had a southerly type of flow. The southerly flow, there was a little bit of a buildup close to the end of the wetland itself, because there was also a curve in the river where it tended to compact the soil up against the bank and made it a little tougher for the oil to break through. But as far as sediment on the bottom, we got nothing, and there was very little surface detection of any oil in the water itself.
Okay, yeah, we have these cyclic oil discharges from, you know, some of these old areas, and sometimes they cover the whole river during the rainy periods.
Yeah, well, I think that I don't think that would happen here, because the flow is actually regulated enough that and the soil is high in silt, so it's pretty compacted. It really wasn't a lot of flow. It was the only time we would have flow would be forced flow after a heavy rain or a heavy snow melt.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Do we have another question on the phone line? Okay, well, we have many more questions written on the computer here. So we have another question from Pennsylvania. During the revegetation and restoration, what measures were utilized to manage the surface and groundwater hydrology?
Well, I'm going to let Mike take a stab at that.
Yeah, what we did was we put in-ground pumps and circulated the groundwater itself. We caused two cones of depression to draw the groundwater to the pumps themselves, and then we pumped the water back up. Back upstream, off-site, and let it flow back down through. And what we did was we regulated the height of the water by the volume of the pumping.
Great, thank you. Let's ask a couple more here. We have Dean from Pennsylvania. Is the recovered oil reusable, and if so, for what purpose or purposes?
We sent it to a recycler. It's used for fuels blending And it's also, and the heavier ends are used for asphalting. So yes, we did recycle all of the oil, and it came out to be about 85,000 gallons by the time we were done.
Okay. Somebody here, Richard, asked, going back to the cost comparisons, wanted to know if there was an RP involved, and if so, as a reimbursement of the cost of consideration.
Yes, there's no RP involved, but yes, we know who it was. But because of the 1911 trust bust of the Standard Oil of New Jersey break up into Esso and Exxon and Chevron and all these other on companies, we can't go after any of them because they broke it up so bad that it basically excluded them from any liability prior to 1911.
Interesting.
They had a really good lawyer.
Thank you. Let's open up one more time to the phone line if anybody has a question. Okay, we still have a bunch of questions here, but why don't we continue on and wait to ask these questions at the end.
Okie dokie. So that puts us on slide 28, still under the heading of monitoring the wetland plant community. And at the point when we decided that we felt it was important to keep track of the species that would be developing in this wetland, we established 6 transect lines. And on your slide, the transect lines are identified in yellow and are alpha identified. And we had in the one on the left represents the northernmost area, which would be in the more upland area of the wetland. And then, of course, the one down off the right represents the lowest point in the wetland itself. And we used we established a transect, and at every 4 feet intervals, we would do what we call a handprint. We would identify the species and that was living or growing in within a handprint of the at that particular point. This technique is called a point intercept sampling, and it is something that has been identified and is used quite often in plant community analysis, and was something that we discovered in Ralph Tyner's book that the 1989 manual for delineating wetlands.
He is one of the standard techniques that you.
I'm not sure what that is, but just go ahead. Mike? Royal? Audience? Anyone from the audience there?
Yeah, the audience is awesome.
Okay, let me see how the audience here. Let's hold on a second, see what's going on. Maybe they hit a bad button again. But when they get back on, when they hold the microphone up close, can everyone hear better now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Royal, any chance you're back? I thoroughly apologize for these technical difficulties. Let's wait a couple minutes. I'm sure they'll call it back in as they did last time. Do people have ideas for other internet senders they'd like to hear about ecological restoration or revitalization of sites? Any burning questions?
This is Craig Dukowski in Delaware. We're dealing with some estuarine sites, wetland sites in particular, so anything on that would be helpful to us.
Oh, wetlands, okay.
We're back on.
Okay.
I don't know what's happening.
Probably
just kind of dies every now and then.
It's probably me, but on the other hand, we're back.
Okay.
You want me to take a question before I proceed?
No. Just be sure to keep the microphone up close so we can hear you.
Okay. Well, I'm actually holding the set right up now, so microphone is only about 6 inches away from my face.
Perfect.
So we're on the slide 29, where we got into talking about the wetland plant community, which at this point, when we at this point in the game in 1998, being that there had not been that many restorations of an oiled wetland, it was kind of, we thought, it, at least Mike felt it was important that we do this plant community analysis. And one of the things I have to point out here is the importance of getting some good, accurate taxonomic information and consistency, so that the people performing the monitoring or the community analysis are pretty good taxonomic botanists and are going to be continued in the project. And here we had, you see two people who were involved in the project. The top person is Dr. Gary Moore from the Brooklyn Botanical Garden, and he was the person that we used sort of as our ultimate expert when it came to identification issues. So, all right, moving right along to on slide 30. So when we did our analysis of the different types of plants that once we identified the plants that were growing at these transect points, we then went to the wetlands inventory and found out whether the whether this plant was listed as a perennial or as an alien or invasive. The wetlands inventory uses the term introduced, which you can see covers a multitude of centers. And then so on both you folks that are actively in the wetland business, certainly I expect to have seen this this delineation many times before. It helped us, and we maintained this throughout our analysis. All right, we're on slide 31. And this is the breakdown of the different groupings from starting out in 1999 and actually ending up in the growing season of 2005, which was basically at the end of the project. So we had basically 6 years of monitoring. And as you can see, there was a dramatic change and the plant type groupings that occurred as we went through these 6 years. Let's go on to slide 32. Of course, one of the questions that comes to mind was this area going to be maintained or going to be as a wetland, or was the activities of actually scraping off the surface, removing some of the soil, and then planting with this, where would we actually encourage maybe the wetland to become less of a wetland and more of an upland community? So this was one of the issues, and naturally we were concerned about. We certainly didn't want to make to damage the conditions, either the hydrologic regime or whatever, that would cause a shift from a wetland condition to an upland. So we were pretty concerned about the kinds of species that we were observing in that regard. So this slide 32, of course, gives you a breakdown to the nature of the individual species as they have been historically been observed in wetlands throughout the Northeast. Slide 33 gives you an idea of the change and the of the wetland character in the community. And you can see that we in the initial year, after the initial growing year, we did certainly have some wetland plants that were more associated with upland, And these were, I guess, I would call those our pioneer species that we came in. And what we'll, I'll show you as we go further, and the next slide is going to tell you a little bit about what the number of species that actually and how long they came, lasted throughout the 6 years. So you can see that we actually, if you look at the number of species, we had the greatest number of species in the actual first growing year, first growing season, and then it tapered off as we went in, which is, those of you that are plant ecologists know that this is really not that strange when you're starting out with a fresh area that's been scraped clean. Your pioneers are going to, species are going to show themselves very early on, and then as other species come in and take their place, they're not going to compete as well, and they'll be diminished. And you can readily see this in that particular slide. Okay, slide 34. This is, again, the slide that actually talks about the number of species and how long they lasted. And see, we had actually the greatest number of species were only there 1 year. And that we had the species that were present from start to finish, there was less than 10 species that was occurred throughout the entire 7 years that we were monitoring the wetlands. Now, getting back to one of the areas that we have spent quite a bit of effort was regarding the invasives. And that's obviously a topic for, you know, a webcast onto its own. But naturally, when you are performing a wetland revegetation or an establishment, there is this matter of how do you deal with so-called introduced species. And this definitely, all these species that you see here on this particular slide, you can see a lot of them were there early on, were noted to be present right off the start, you know, in September 99 when we did our first survey. And some of them, for instance, like the loosestrife, were present throughout the entire project period. You know, and then the bottom one, of course, fox grape, which is introduced but is not considered a real invasive, even though it's present through both upland and wetland communities, was throughout the entire project. I'd like to point out with the slide 36 that even before the start of the removal of the oil-contaminated soils, if you look closely in the midsection of that photo, you will notice that there's quite a bit of purple. And that purple, of course, represents loosestrife. So the loosestrife was there actually before we actually started the cleanup. And as we get into talking a little bit more about loosestrife, it isn't too surprising that it was able to maintain its hold on the wetland. Slide 37 talks about the actual invasive species management that we got into there at Green Pond, and this was something that that Mike was able to justify under this particular executive order in terms of the use of federal funds to actually detect, monitor, and remove invasive species that were showed up at this particular site. Purple loosestrife obviously became the object of our wrath, as it is the object of the wrath of many wetland professionals here in the Northeast. We started out thinking, well, we'll try a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and we started out with a little bit of Roundup, and we soon decided that since we were seeing so much in the way of loose strife there, that if for us to use herbicides throughout, this would really was not a good idea, being that there was, you know, the drinking water supply was so close by. So that was just kind of a little experiment on our part, and we abandoned that. We then went on to hand extraction. You know, as we tried to do that before the plants went to, this was slide 39. This shows, I guess some people would say, though, this is pretty dramatic and a pretty desperate attempt, and I would agree with them in that regard. It certainly is labor intensive. And if you notice how we're dressed in Tyvek, and that was not only because it would satisfy the safety aspects, but primarily because you can see ticks a lot better on Tyvek than you can on your regular clothing, and that, at least, that's been my observation. So anyhow, we didn't wind up using the hand extraction as our ultimate removal or control method. And we did resort to doing some clipping, not only in the spring. This is slide 40. And we tried to figure out what was sensible in this, and clipping in the spring to cut down on the seed production, and then even we clipped the flowering structures in the late summer before seed maturation. You must remember, on the right you see there's just one little seed pod with a myriad of seeds that have actually just come out of that pod. One plant in one season can produce over 2 million seeds. So that gives you some idea of the prolific capabilities of loosestrife and why it is so abundant and distributed universally in its habitat, particularly here in the Northeast. Next slide, 41. We fortunately found out that the state of New Jersey, the Department of Agriculture, has a program for biological control of a variety of species, some of which are more agriculture, have importance. As you know, New Jersey is known as the Garden State. Some of you folks out there probably find that a little surprising from what you have been told about New Jersey being the most populous state in the Union, which it is, but at the same time, it is known as the Garden State because it does have a tremendous amount of agriculture, particularly when it comes to growing vegetables primarily. So the state has a program that uses biological controls. As part of this program, they raise and distribute the Gallicella beetles, both species, the Camarensis and the Pacella, for controlling loosestrife. And they have distributed these beetles, the loosestrife beetles, at a number of different locations throughout the state, and mostly on state properties, the public lands. And we were able to have the man in charge of that, Tom Scudder, come up and take a look at our site to see if he felt it might be a candidate, and he indicated that he felt it was. So in the next spring, or next year, we were able to purchase some of these adults from the state, because again, even though this was public lands, the state really thought it was a site that was too small, I think, in many cases, and we didn't know. And besides, we were so low on the totem pole that we really had to, as far as their priorities for putting out beetles, publicly owned beetles. They decided we could purchase some, and that's what we did. And this is on slide 42. Okay, and here you see Craig Bittler, who happens to be a loosestrife expert with the Fish and Wildlife Service, is distributing these beetles on that in July of 2002. We put out 3,000 beetles of that first year. Okay, on slide 43, you get a chance to look at some of these beetles up close and personal. Here's the container they come in. They came in, and then here's what they look like when we put them out on the loosestrife. Now, slide 44. All right. So here it is. You can see the adults. Exactly, you can see a leaf that the adults have been chewing on. And then on the bottom slide, you actually see the larvae. And the larvae serve a very important function of actually preferring the meristem or the atypical part of the plant, which is the softest, fastest growing uppermost portion of the plant. And once that is damaged, that it has the potential for stunting the growth and may even able to really impede on the flower production. So the larvae serve a very, very important function. Now, you get a little sense for the life stage there. And so the eggs are laid starting in May and going through August, so you can have the potential for getting a number of generations if you're lucky, so to speak, at a particular site. The adults, once these larvae have morphosized into adults, will drop down and overwinter in the soil and then emerge in May and June. Our first couple of years, and let's go on to slide 45. Our first couple of years, we did not see evidence of adults emerging in May and June, so we then went ahead and purchased more beetles we put out later in the summer. Since that time, though, a native population or an indigenous population of beetles has become established. So the last few years, I would say since 2003, onward, we have actually seen beetles there early in the season, which means that they've overwintered. Now, let me then go on. This is slide 45, where you can actually see the hula hoop affair with the gray pole. We established 10 sampling locations that were 1 square meter in size, and according to a protocol that was developed by Dr. Bernd Blossi of Cornell University. And this was a protocol designed by Dr. Blossi for actually counting and establishing the density and a lot of critical parameters for measuring the populations of loosestrife beetles in a large number of wetlands that Dr. Blossi was looking for. Gathering information on throughout the Northeast. So we decided we would participate in that. Not only was it provide useful information to Dr. Blossi, but it was something that we were interested in as well. Because during that time, as many of you know, there's been a very big interest in invasive species and control, particularly biological control of loosestrife in particular. So this slide 46 gives you a sense of where we actually had put these particular the location of the quadrants for these service for monitoring. Okay, 47. We had a number of different parameters that we had to measure, which was kind of labor intensive. That's one of the reasons why we weren't able to carry it on actually more than 2 years in the program. But some of these things that we observed during those, that two-year time frame that we were monitoring the loose strike beetles, you can see in this slide 47, and this is a kind of a quick synopsis. We counted the number of flower heads that, within these quadrants, and we saw that from 1 year to another that, that there was a significant decrease in the number of flower heads, and that for the number of flowers per inflorescence or per flower head, there was a significant decrease as well, which indicates that flower production was affected by the beetles. And the number of stems and cover within each sampling quadrant, there was, at some locations, there was a decrease in percent cover and stem, but not at all locations. And at the height within each sampling, we did not notice a significant decrease in the height of the loosestrife. But keeping in mind that the loosestrife itself has a real significant root system, which would supply a lot of the energy and nutrients to really get the loosestrife in a fall growing condition. Now, again, the beetle population levels itself, the key to a successful biocontrol program using beetles is if you can get the adults to overwinter and then the following season to produce the number of egg clusters and larvae that you need in order to then come out and start nibbling away at the freshly emerged loosestrife, and that's the way that you can hopefully you can get some degree of control. I have to tell you though that you probably will never get rid of the loosestrife using biocontrols, but you will bring it into more manageable so in which case then you can hope that perhaps once you're able to do that, that you will see perhaps other large plant species that would have been growing there before the loosestrife came in that will either spread out into areas or at least maintain themselves, in which case that's one of the things that we were able to see at Green Pond, is that we never lost the other species that were present there, namely the Joe Pye weed. We had two different species of Joe Pye weed, the spotted and the world, and also of course the really stellar, outstanding plant there that would be considered a competitor to loosestrife is the New York ironweed. Now let's go to that's on 48. Now let's go to 49 and talk about some of the other alien or invasives that we've had to deal with that we did not see present in the early years. And this latest character that we're having to deal with is the Nepalese stiltgrass, Mycostygium, which even though is classified as an annual, it certainly shows up in great profusion and year after year. And from that standpoint, one could easily be fooled into thinking it was a perennial. Now, although we saw very little in the way of actual numbers of Japanese barberry plants in the marsh itself, I think only maybe one or two plants which we took out, but we did have quite a large stands of Japanese barberry in the upland portion of the site. And there we actually were able to, going on to slide number 50, again, using that Craig Bittler, as you saw once before, who has had a lot of experience with Japanese barberry control using spray. And I have to say, it was phenomenally effective. We got like 99% effectiveness using the glyphosate. there. I guess we must have hit it just right in terms of the window of opportunity, which there happens to be something like a window of opportunity in late fall when the plants are drawing energy down into the root systems. And if you can hit it to where the glyphosate application will actually, the plant will draw the chemical into its root system, you can find that it'd be very, very effective. Okay, slide 51. Let's go on to, we're now off talking about the invasive species management so much, and we're now going to talk about some of the visitors. And if you look down at the bottom, it's kind of like, as you see, if you build it, will they come? And this is sort of where we get a little bit light in our presentation. In one of our, at least in the early years, one of our visitors, as you see, the black bear, which there is a quite a significant population in this area of Green Pond, up in that neck of the woods, is where the concentration of black bears in New Jersey occurs. Here in the lower left corner, you see Ozzy. Mike named this guy, we say it's a male, because he had an infinite curiosity, and here you see him poking his head into one of the buildings where we had one of the recovery wells. At this point, I don't think there was anybody in that building, right, Mike? No. Off to the right-hand side, we see Harriet with her kids. And that picture I took, and I have to say that even though you can't see it in that picture, it was pretty interesting because Harriet had four cubs. That had been a very good year for cub production. Now, as you can see, we actually saw them in person, and we saw them in evidence otherwise, as you can see by the other pictures. Now, the picture up in the right-hand corner is there because it shows you what they were interested in, and that is the large number of rush seeds that had been accumulated in a given area by the meltwaters and had actually floated these seeds into clumps. And actually, this is what drew the bears. As you know, bears are omnivorous. And they will take advantage of any seed clusters or anything that they know serves as food. And this actually was a pretty good source of protein for them, of these large accumulations of these large masses of rush seeds. Okay, let's go on to 52. And this is kind of interesting we realized that why the bears were actually being found on our site. We actually were in the midst of a corridor, a wildlife corridor, that extended underneath. We feel they were actually using the bridge for the Taquonic River underneath Route 23, and the bears were actually coming underneath. Walking alongside or to get from the northern sector there at the top to the bottom area. And as you can see, that Route 23 is a very, very busy highway. It's a divided highway. It's the main artery that goes from, the populous area in northern New Jersey to up to Sussex County and then on to Port Jervis, New York. So it so happened that we discovered that our site was actually in the midst of one of these wildlife corridors. Okay, that's slide 52. Let's go on to slide 53. Again, if you build it, will they come? And here we have another visitor of a quite dramatic. It was a large black rat snake, or what is sometimes known as a pilot snake. And it was, that's a very obvious and dramatic visitor to the site. I saw this snake there in front of our equipment shack, which is where you see the pictures. And then actually I saw him down on the marsh, which is where the picture I took on the right-hand side is the same snake. Okay, slide 54. Oh yes, Mike reminds me that we did observe rattlesnakes, which in the area that's just, and water snakes as well. Now, one of the other species, the other reptiles that we saw was actually one that is listed as a threatened species in New Jersey, and that is the wood turtle. And here on the left picture is showing the turtle as it was actually in the wetland area itself, and then the two pictures on the right were pictures we took of wood turtles. I'm not sure whether it's the same one, but these turtles were observed trying to actually establish nesting areas on the upland portion of the site. And one of the reasons why they are threatened is because of the fact that their nest sites are raided quite often by raccoons. So their survivability of the hatchlings is really threatened. Okay, slide 55. Yeah, Mike mentioned earlier about some unwelcome visitors that we had in the winter or late winter of 2002. We showed up and we discovered that we didn't have much in the way of any shrubbery left. Our willows and alders that we had planted were basically been lopped off right down to the stem, as you can see there in that picture. My first impression when I saw that, vandal, because it looks like there's such clean cuts. And then as we got to look at it a little bit closer, we realized that it really wasn't a machete cut. It was more like a tooth marks. And someone pointed out to me that when you have shrubbery this size, instead of the beaver girdling or moving their way around, they just move up to it and turn their head and just chomp, and they can lop those things off, lop the branches off real quick. And that's exactly what they did. And what it turns out, which was kind of interesting, is they left none of it behind. Lots of times in places where you see beaver activity, you will see that if they lop the branches down, they'll chew on the bark and they'll leave the core of the branch there. But in this case, they took it off site, which I thought was quite a feat because they actually had to get it through the deer fence. But they managed to do it. So hats off to the beavers. Thank God they decided not to come back the following years. And I should say that this slide 56 shows that by the end of the growing season, the shrubs had actually regained their original stature and density in terms of number of sprouts, so that really there was no harm done by the beaver, and probably by some people's standards they say they actually had stimulated the more production by creating more sprouting. So the shrub community is alive and well and at the Green Pond. Okay, let's go to slide 57. And gives you a little idea of some of the other visitors that we had at the Green Pond, more of the aerial type. Now, you know, I will have to say that the loosestrife serves a purpose when it comes to supporting insect populations and pollinators. But at the same time, as was observed when I was doing the flower clipping, even though maybe the bees were temporarily upset with me, they moved on to other plants that were non-loosestrife that were in the adjacent area. So I have to say, if the loosestrife wasn't there and you had other large flowering plants in the area, that you wouldn't have too many unhappy bees that might have been looking for a loosestrife to begin with. Okay, slide 58. As far as butterflies and moths are concerned, we had quite a diversity that came in at the different times of year. These are just a sampling that you see here of the different species of butterflies. I don't see where I have any moths depicted, but there were other moths present. And of course, with these species here, you see only the adults that are actually feeding on the flowers. But it turns out there are a large number of moths where the other life forms, whether it be larval, in some cases, there's one plant called the cutler's root that actually has, in New Jersey at least, a rare species of moth that uses the cutler's root of the borer for the larval stage for a root for a food supply. I might add that, as you know, the pollinators, which the moths and butterflies are part of, are actually being threatened, are in jeopardy in large areas of our country. So when I observed these, I felt at Green Pond, I felt good that they were there. And some of the other interesting insects that we found there were the predaceous type, in the form of the spiders, and so they certainly added another dimension to the diversity of wildlife that we observed, established itself there at Green Pond. Now, were these animals or were these insects there before? Probably. But at least they didn't go away. We didn't, make a situation where they didn't reestablish themselves or at least they were able to establish themselves after the plants came up. Okay, this is onward to slide number 60, where we're actually going to talk about some of the insects that are actually more associated with the wetland itself. A lot of the insects and animals that you've seen depicted so far would not necessarily have chosen or be associated with wetlands, but it was nice that they were there. Here, you actually see... you see insects that are more associated with wetlands, and so that gave us a sense that our wetland was serving a function as a habitat for wetland species. Okay, slide 61. Basically, what have we learned so far? Bottom line. And this is something that Mike and I have talked about. And this is, you see, there's basically five main bullets that we feel we've come to realize and that we think is worth passing on to any of you folks that might find yourself faced with an oiled wetland or a wetland that's been contaminated to such a degree that you feel like it's the only recourse is to remove soil, that if you can remove the minimal amount, in this case, Mike was stripped only 4 to 6 inches, which was the amount that he felt that he needed to in order to get rid of the bulk of the oil that was remaining in the upper 4 to 6 inches of wetland soil. And that in so doing, that the root systems of the plants that were in place was able to remain intact. So that we discovered that the low level of soil TPH following the cleanup were low, that the levels were low enough that certainly it did not affect the shrub or the planted material. It probably was useful that we actually used potted material, since actually the plants were established and were actually growing in non-contaminated material that was, you know, brought on site and within the pots themselves. So that was worthwhile, knowing that the TPH levels that still were in the soil were not affecting the shrub survival. And likewise, that the occasional oil spooges that would show up in the beginning of each growing season, that actually we noted, as I mentioned before, that these spooges did not affect the plant community as a whole. And even the plants that were actually growing in close approximation, because these plants had been established there before the oil cleanup, that they were not affected by the oil that was bubbling up periodically. And that had to do with the fact was probably the oil was well weathered and didn't have a lot of toxic components in it. So it was a combination of actual factors that went into this as to why the plants were not affected by the oil. And that even though we had several seasons of drought, there was a significant amount of wetness that was due to the groundwater itself, the high water table, and the snow melt, and the fact that there was, you know, the river would flood the area over a significant period of time where that was able to maintain the wet conditions to keep the plant community as a wetland plant community and not allow it to evolve or to succeed into an upland dominant. Last but not least, in terms of the invasive species, you got to know that, as you saw there, they were there before, and they most likely will show up afterwards. In fact, in some cases, you will see new ones, and they will be something that you're going to have to deal with, not only during the course of the restoration project, but during the monitoring. And I would dare say two things in addition to this, is that, of course, in order to keep an eye on the invasive species, you've got to have a management plan, which, of course, monitoring is a must-do. Part of that management plan. And then, of course, naturally, the bottom is you got to watch out for the beavers, the snakes, and bears. All right, let's move on to slide 62, which basically is a set of guiding principles that was established for, you know, restoration projects, and it's a kind of a score sheet. And you can see that there's quite a number of parameters. I'm not going to go down through each one, just more or less to tell you that we hit on each one and felt that we accomplished to a large degree the objectives that were set by this by these guiding principles. For doing restorations. And this works for not only wetlands, but for upland restorations as well. Okay, slide 63 just gives you a brief exposure to some of the visitors that we had during the course of the project. You know, as you can see in the upper left-hand corner is the file control director from the state. And then over on the right-hand corner, of course, is Dr. Harry Howland, who served as one of our consultants regarding the oiled soils and the impacts, particularly as it relates to the possibly any bioremediation that might be occurring in the soils, which we got some indication that there was. There was alteration of the oil throughout the time period. And so quite a variety. We had quite a large number of groups that came through during the course of the time period. And then the last slide, I'll have to give credit to Sundance, who was very instrumental in helping me with data manipulation, as you can see from that site. And basically, that's the end of the show, folks. So, I guess, Ellen, if you...
Yep, thanks Royal Mike, that was excellent. If everyone could click over to slide 65, we want to thank you for attending, and we will continue to answer questions. But let's first link to additional resources. Once you click there, you can see all the additional resources that are available to you. Also, if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see feedback. Please fill out the survey and give us feedback on this, because we do read it, and we provide new internet seminars that you have suggestions on and update older seminars. So with that said, let's go to questions. We have a lot of questions that were written into me, so why don't we start with those. We have William from Pennsylvania who asked, do you consider the vegetation based on its tolerance to oil contamination? And have you considered any phytoremediation approaches?
No, we didn't. In regards to that question, no, we did it strictly on what was available and what we knew in terms of shrubbery that would do well in a wetland situation. So, in fact, that's the reason why we did the oil monitoring, oil and soil monitoring, was to get an idea of possibly which shrubs would do better in that kind of an oil-soil environment.
Great, thank you. Okay, Vincent from Pennsylvania asks, Mike's discussion on slide 10 indicated that oil-contaminated soil was removed and transported off-site for disposal. Was there any consideration given to ex-situ on-site bioremediation, natural attenuation of the oil-contaminated soil? And also, one more, was backfill brought in, and if so, were the requirements to backfill the soil compatible with what was removed?
We didn't replace any soil. We took bioremediation into consideration as far as adding things to it, but we decided it wasn't a good thing at this particular site because it really wasn't a large enough site, and what was available at the time would not really handle the problems that we were having with this type of oil. But we did, I'm trying to remember the rest of the question. We didn't do anything extra as far as bioremediation or phytoremediation. We wanted it to see what would happen if all we did was remove the oil and just go back to its natural state to see what would actually survive and what wouldn't.
Great, thank you.
I guess that's what she
had. Yeah. we have Richard asked a question. Overall, would you say there were any of the native species that seemed better adapted to the contamination and possibly aided in remediation? If yes or no, could the results have been influenced by the degraded nature of the oil, and were the results expected to be different with fresher oil? That was a long question. Did you get all that?
In regards to the first part of that question,
mm-hmm.
Being that we didn't see any particular spot that had high residual oil that we could say that certain species seem to do better in those areas than others.
Okay.
I'll be honest, in the area of the spooges, where there actually was, as you saw on those slides, there was oil that was bubbling up. As the plants developed, particularly the rushes and the sedges, we saw the same clusters come back year after year after year and with just as much vigor from one year to another. I was quite surprised. So what that showed me is that even though it was high concentrations of oil, say within a foot or two of the plants, the root systems were not really actually being affected. Even though in some cases some of the leaves were actually oiled, but not enough to where it actually you know, cause the plants to be in stress. So bottom line is I would say that the native plants, particularly the sedges and rushes, have a great resilience when it comes to dealing with weathered oil. Now, a fresh oil spill, well, that would be, you know, say, like a home heating oil that would, say, be coming from a truck spill or something like that, that would be occurring possibly during a springtime when your growth was being established. Well, that would be a whole different picture. And I can actually see where that would be possible. And I think both Mike and I have been seen occasions where you do have what is known as, plant burn or leaf burn from products like home heating oils, and certainly from gasoline. Gasoline is probably the worst of any petroleum product for when it comes to plant damage.
Great. My next question is Emil from Texas. He wants to know if there is an ecological risk assessment performed for the wetland wildlife habitat.
Not from the standpoint of where I think most people would associate, what is now the way that risk assessments would be performed. This was started out before we got into doing risk assessments like the way they are now. But remember, we did have this group of experts that were part of the restoration team. So we had representatives from the various groups that would have, would likely have an interest in the kinds of things that risk assessment would be performed on. Namely, you know, that the various species that would be species of concern. I was actually asked while they were developing the protocols for risk assessment to be one of the people that, you know, that contributed, and this was one of the sites that we used to develop the protocols that we're using today for the risk assessment. We were one of the first ones to, we were one of the last ones to not do it.
Okay. Great. Okay, let's continue on. We have Jennifer from Pennsylvania who asked, referring to slide 25, how does hopane help in the fingerprint identification source? Does it determine if the oil is naturally occurring?
The ratio of hopane to the other compounds identified there, hopane is a very resistant compound. And when it occurs in oil, it's a kind of a telltale. So in terms of whether the hydrocarbons that you're observing are petroleum origin or of natural origin. So that's why we use that ratio of hopane over whatever else we see to give us some idea of the extent that the oil that's present there would be of petroleum origin or natural. As I said, in any, especially in a wetland situation, you will find upwards to at least 25 parts per million of naturally occurring hydrocarbon materials, some of which results from plant oils that are produced and are residual in the soils. Just by the fact that you have so much plant production going on.
Okay, let's open up questions to the phone line. Does anyone have any questions on the phone line? Okay, well, I have many more questions here. So we have Sajid from Canada who asks, what was the concentration of naturally occurring hydrocarbons in the wetland area? And he also asked, on the initial slide, did it appear that there was an abundant, healthy vegetation? Why was it necessary to remove it and replant?
What was that first question, Ellen?
The first one was, what was the concentration of naturally occurring hydrocarbons in the wetland area?
I'll have to go back to slide 25. And you can actually get a sense. I may not have the actual...
We can get back to
You know what?
Why don't we get back to more on that one? Because we have limited time left to ask questions.
We actually had to remove some of the slides from our original presentation in order to cut down the time, and then I think that was one of them that we did.
Okay, we'll get back to it. I will note it. His second question was, it appeared that there were abundant, healthy vegetation initially on the first slide, and was it necessary to why was it necessary to remove it and replant?
Well, I'm going to... I have my answer for that, but I'm going to let Mike take that one. There was so much freestanding oil within the wetland itself that the only way to really remove that freestanding oil was to actually just basically shave the top.
Mm-hmm.
And since I knew I was doing my best and I had a really good operator, that we weren't affecting the root system, we didn't feel that it was a big deal to remove the tops of the plants as long as we kept the roots intact. And we were still able to remove the loose oil, the free oil. Anyway, that's what we did.
Great. Okay, we have another question, which I think you answered already, but let's make sure. We have Richard from South Bend. He says, some soil removal has been mentioned a few times. Was any of the removed soil volume replaced before the restoration?
No soil replacement at all.
Okay, no soil replacement. And our next question comes from Pennsylvania. I noticed that the bar graph on slide 31, that the native and introduced forms were reduced in the middle years. Could that be the result of disturbed conditions during the restoration effort, or is it something else happening?
No, that's something else that's happened. There was no activity in terms of removal that was done after, 1998. So everything was left to sort of, take its own way. And I found that very interesting myself as to why we had an upshot of these perennial natives there in 2005. I probably would have to go in and do a much more elaborate analysis, keeping in mind that the graph here is a compendium of data that's taken from all of the sampling locations. So there probably was in one particular area, something that was going on that really skewed the data in that regard. I'd have to go back and see. But it was kind of interesting that we had a suppression or diminishing of a number of species up to that, through growing season 2004, and then all of a sudden, we had in the growing season of 2005, we had those particular categories that showed themselves in greater numbers.
Okay, let's. Next question is John from Pennsylvania. He says on slide 34, over the 7 years, it appears that natural succession is taking over and the pioneer species are being replaced by the higher successional stages. Is this what is happening?
I think so. I credit a lot of the change in the plant community due to succession itself. I could give a whole different. I could go give another whole presentation, just on the plant community analysis, because I would be able to to use all of the photographic documentation in with that, with the plant community analysis. So you'd be able to see not only where the number of species or the statistics were playing, but you'd also be able to see in terms of the photographic evidence of the plant community.
Great. Let's open it up one more time to the phone line if anyone came up with a question. Okay, we'll continue on with the written questions. Steve from Georgia asked, aside from the alders, which from the growth rate appears to have established successfully, were there any other hand-planted species which contributed significantly to their eventual plant community? That is, were the hand plantings really helpful in restoring the site?
The other shrubbery that really did well at this plant, the site, or the dogwoods. We used two species, the amamum and the stolonifera, the sericea, and they have had a high degree of survivability, and not only that, but have proliferated throughout the site. The other species have done some of the alders and the willows have proliferated, but mostly they have grown in place and really have amassed a large biomass per individual, whereas the corner species have multiplied in numbers, but of course cornice by nature takes a long time for it to develop into really a high biomass plant.
Right. Okay. We have William from Pennsylvania who asks, regarding the beetles for control of purple loosestrife, is there a danger that they will leave the site and damage other crops and plants?
Mm-hmm. I know that's a question that has come up, but the evidence seems to not indicate that. We were hoping that the beetles would get up to such numbers and to where they would leave the site and go and attack some of the loosestrife that was growing further downstream, along the stream itself, and then into another wetland. That was maybe about a half a mile or a quarter of a mile or three quarters of a mile downstream. As far as we can tell, we only observed beetles on the loosestrife itself. And we did look to see if in that monitoring program that I mentioned, there was one of the questions was, are the beetles, are they eating other plants besides loosestrife, and we didn't observe that.
Okay, great. Okay, we got Walter from Pennsylvania who asks, regarding invasive species management, is this something that should be considered at all sites, or are there exceptions such as very rural sites?
I think you have to, I would say yes, and because I think the risk is so high for alien or invasive species to really ruin a well-planned, a well-installed, or instigated restoration, that you've got to be prepared to really be aggressive. Some people probably would say biocontrol is probably not the most aggressive way of controlling loosestrife, and I would agree with them up to a certain point, but on the other hand, using chemicals in some of those more radical techniques that are more labor intensive, it's a way to go. It certainly is cost effective. We ended up having to pay a dime a beetle, which I guess by some people's standards that would be pretty expensive, but it turns out the state, that's the best deal we could possibly have gotten. I think I've heard that Cornell, which was also in the business of providing beetles, charges 50 cents a beetle, and that's kind of like, in my book, that's really robbery. But on the other hand, lots of people that I know that have actually used the beetles get them from other sites.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be, and I know that that's the way the Fish and Wildlife Service, they actually raise their own beetles, and they will actually transport them from, you know, from one part of the country to another to establish beetle populations.
Okay, sounds good. We have a couple more questions still to get through. We have Eli from Texas who asked, how many more years is monitoring planned?
I have to tell you, as sad to say, the funding was finished in 2005, and except for, you know, maybe occasional visits, twice a year visits that Mike and I go up there, there's really no established monitoring that's in place at this point in time. So what you see is what you get.
Okay, our last question is from Canada, and they ask, the number of species was reduced at the end of the project. Is this related to the biological control or the soil contaminated or due to the project plan?
I don't think it's any of those. I think it's just the fact that it's just, and we've done some literature search on this, and I think it's just a function of the plant community and the succession that occurs when you start out with bare dirt and you wind up. That's why many times in any established mature plant community you will wind up with dominance of certain species, and so your diversity will not be of what it was, say, originally when you started out. It's just a simple, I think that's something that's been observed lots and lots.
Okay, let's open up one last time to the phone line. Any last minute questions? This is your last opportunity to ask. Well, not really, because you can always, there's the emails that you have of both speakers, so you can send them questions, you can send me questions, and feel free to do that. But if there's any questions on the phone line right now? Okay. Well, thank you, Mike and Royal, for another very good presentation. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate everyone's time who listened in. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Ellen.
Sure.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.